This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Miami yesterday, federal air marshals opened fire on a passenger who was acting erratically. A man, they say, claimed to have a bomb and then bolted down the aisle of the plane and out onto the jetway that connected the aircraft to the terminal. A spokesman for the federal air marshals said that Rigoberto Alpizar refused to obey commands to stop, and when he reached into his backpack, he was shot and killed by two air marshals. Our main focus today is what happened and why, on what federal air marshals are trained to do and when they're trained to do it, on whether they made the right call, whether the policy they acted under is right, and if it should be changed. If you have questions, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and the confusion surrounding her statements about torture and secret prisons in Europe. Speaking yesterday in Kiev, the capital of the Ukraine, the Secretary of State said that U.S. agents are under the same strictures whether in the United States or overseas, that under no circumstances are they authorized to use degrading, inhumane treatment for prisoners or detainees. That's a statement that appears to be at odds with previous assertions by the Bush administrations that overseas American agents are not under the same strictures as they would be on American soil. We'll ask about that. But first, what happened yesterday afternoon on American Airlines Flight 924? That's the flight that originated in Ecuador, stopped in Medellin in Colombia, and then flew on to Miami before it was to make another scheduled stop in Orlando, Florida. The man who was killed, Rigoberto Alpizar, is a 44-year-old American citizen, and he lived in Florida. Joining us now is Douglas Laird, president of Laird & Associates, an aviation security consulting firm. He was former security director at Northwest Airlines. And, Mr. Laird, very good of you to be with us today.
Thank you.
And I wonder, as a former security director, what's your take on what happened aboard that airplane yesterday?
Oh, I believe it's, I would categorize it as a no-win situation. The air marshal did what, or I guess there were two of them, did what they have to do under, you know, circumstances that forced the issue. I wish there was a better answer, but I can't think of what it would be.
Yeah. Now, you were at Northwest, I guess, before 9/11?
I was at Northwest from 1989 till 1995, so yes, before 9/11.
And obviously things have changed a great deal since then, most decisively with the Air Marshals Program considerably expanded since those days.
There were air marshals prior to 9/11, but they were very few in number, and they flew basically international flights only.
And that was sort of almost a vestigial, remnant of a policy that was created when there were a lot of airline hijackings to Cuba back in the 60s and 70s.
Sure, it's a follow-up of the Take Me to Cuba scenario.
And obviously another thing that's changed since then, since 9/11, obviously the Air Marshal Program has expanded considerably, but also new security measures have gone into effect, reinforced cockpit doors, for example.
Yes.
And with that, do you think the Air Marshal Program is still as important today as it was before all those changes went into place?
You know, I have no question about what happened in Miami. I think they were forced to do what they did. And situations like that happen in law enforcement, you know, whether it's air marshals or police officers. The question regarding federal air marshals in the program is, with the reinforced cockpit doors, I don't believe that the scenario followed on 9/11 would work today. Also, I don't believe the passengers would allow it to happen. That being said, I would question whether the money we spend on air marshals could be better spent on other programs, for example, intelligence. You know, my thought would be, let's do everything we can to identify these folks before they get to the airplane.
In the few seconds that an air marshal would have to respond to a bomb threat, and we're talking generically and not specifically about what happened yesterday,
sure.
What's likely to go through their minds in terms of how to read and react to a passenger?
Well, the terrible question that they face is, I believe there could be two switches. One switch you'd press to activate the device, and the second would be that you'd release a switch. And the air marshal or police officer has no idea how that device is wired. So under some circumstances, shooting the person would be the correct choice. Under others, it would be the wrong choice. And there's no easy answer.
In other words, it could be a so-called dead man switch where if they're shot, they release something and that triggers the bomb.
Yes.
So there's
very frightening. Very frightening.
Very frightening. There's also the possibility of a mistake.
Mistakes happen all the time. Unfortunately, you know, in the grand scheme of things, there's not that many. But, you know, you've heard about and read about where an individual is stopped by a traffic officer and reaches inside his or her coat to get something and is shot. The police officer thinking it's a gun, and it turns out to be a placard that says, you know, I can't speak, or, you know, whatever. Those things happen every couple of years.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with John. John calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, am I on the air?
Yes, you're on the air, John. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was curious why the person was shot to be killed. I've worked in security, and I know when I was a child that they used to shoot the person in the leg to maybe disable them. And also the person was away from the aircraft. I don't think a bomb could have, you know, done as much damage as if it was at the aircraft. Why is the policy immediately to shoot to kill? It seems excessive.
Douglas Laird, do you have any idea?
Sure. Two comments. Firstly, the individual, as I understand it, was going up the jetway back into the terminal where there were a lot of people. So that probably played on the officer's decision. Secondly, on the shoot to kill, when the decision is made to shoot, whether it's a FAM, you know, federal air marshal or law enforcement officer, the chances are good that shooting that individual will result in death. Therefore, whenever the decision is made to shoot, the decision is that the person could very likely die.
Well, yes, but that's
what it's only in the movies where people shoot the gun out of the guy's hand by hitting his wrist. You know that.
Well, no. You're taking it another direction. I'm asking that why was he not shot? When you shoot a person in the leg, that puts a extreme shock on them, and that would more than likely move the person, you know, away from his backpack.
All the training I've ever received on the local and federal level in law enforcement,
right,
37 years has been right. When you shoot for body mass and
right. I understand that, and that's what I'm questioning is why do we do that? You know, I'm a Vietnam veteran and I've converted to Buddhism, and you know, I have a little different tack on. I think that's excessive.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Obviously, the body mass is a bigger target than the leg, isn't it, Douglas Laird?
Sure, and under times of stress, I mean, many times police officers that do well on the range actually end up not even hitting the person they're shooting at because of the terrible adrenaline rush. Therefore, you aim at body mass, and it's a decision nobody ever has to be wants to be faced with, but unfortunately, it comes with the job.
Let's get another caller in. This is Aaron. Aaron calling us from Baltimore.
Yes, hi. You know, your show is very compelling today. I am a flight attendant for a major airline, and having lost six friends on 9/11, I find this incident in Miami quite sobering. And my hat's off to the Sky Marshals. They did exactly what they had to do, given the situation. Nobody knows if his wife was a decoy. Nobody knows in situations like this. You cannot second-guess something like this.
Let me just insert, Aaron, that for those who hadn't followed the story closely, apparently his wife was following him down the aisle as he was running down that the center part of the Boeing 357, shouting, my husband, he's ill.
You don't know if this is a decoy or not, and this is what we are trained in in-flight training. Often hijackers and rabble-rousers do not travel singly. They travel with someone that serves as a decoy. You don't know this, and your first caller that said that if he had, God forbid, detonated some sort of explosive device on the jetway, it could have taken out a substantial portion of the terminal in addition to that aircraft because there are fuel trucks around there. And what would have happened if, God forbid, this person went berserk on the airplane now that the TSA, in their infinite wisdom, has decided to allow 7-inch sharp objects back on board aircraft. What would have happened if he had a screwdriver and he was going for someone? I mean, he could have been running up the aisle. He could have aimed for a flight attendant. He could have aimed for a pilot that was standing probably at the flight deck door during deplaning or boarding. You cannot second-guess situations like this. And I think the Sky Marshals reacted exactly as they were supposed to do. You act like a crazy nutcase on an airplane, and you know what? In this post-9/11 world, you just might lose your life.
Aaron, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Douglas Laird, I did want to ask you, obviously, again, this situation, we're not exactly sure of everything that has happened on that plane, but it is a fine line between someone who is acting erratically and somebody who is acting as a threat to the aircraft.
Yes, and in today's world, as the previous caller mentioned, you can suffer from such actions. There have been cases even just before 9/11 where people have acted erratically on airplanes and were literally killed by the other passengers. It's unfortunate that those things happen, but again, I wish I had an easy answer. There are none.
No, it's a difficult situation, and obviously, are air marshals, to your knowledge, trained to intervene when somebody is, drunk or berating the flight attendants?
That's another difficult call that they've been criticized for this sometimes by not taking action with a drunk, obnoxious passenger. Their role is to protect the integrity of the flight, not necessarily to deal with rude and obnoxious people. And as the previous caller said, there can be decoys in that you would have a person, you know, act up so that the air marshals that identify themselves so that the other team members, the terrorists, could act appropriately.
Yeah.
Those are really tough calls, and I'm impressed by the training that the federal air marshals receive. And as previously stated, we shouldn't second guess what happened. I think they made a difficult decision that had to be made.
Douglas Laird, stay with us. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about air marshals and how they're trained to handle threatening behavior from passengers. Did they make the right call yesterday? I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation after the news from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Air marshals shot and killed a man at Miami International Airport yesterday. The passenger is alleged to have yelled that he had a bomb as he ran from the aircraft. He was shot after he ignored orders to stop. Today we're talking about what air marshals, how they're trained, what circumstances do they operate under when deadly force is the only recourse. If you have questions about what happened today or about the training of air marshals, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Douglas Laird, president of Laird & Associates, an aviation security consulting firm. He's former Northwest Airlines security director. And joining us now is Sarah Gu, aviation reporter for The Washington Post. She joins us from the studios at The Washington Post. Sarah, very good of you to be with us today.
Thanks, Neil. It's nice to be here.
There's, I guess, still considerable confusion about exactly what happened on that Boeing 757 yesterday. Can you fill us in on what we know now about the incident?
Well, Neil, we don't know too many details beyond what was reported and indeed it was revealed on live television yesterday. The Federal Air Marshal Service says that the two men who are the air marshals, they said both are men, have been interviewed. They both joined the Air Marshal Service in 2002. One from the Border Patrol and one from the U.S. Customs U.S. Customs officer. One of them spoke Spanish. I know that was a question that many people raised, given that this flight had originated from Colombia. There were many, one would think, some Spanish-speaking passengers on board.
Mm-hmm.
But the investigation has been turned over to the local police in Miami-Dade County in Florida, not the FBI, because as they just revealed yesterday, the FBI is really only in charge of investigating a crime aboard an aircraft, and they believe this man was shot in the jetway, which is technically on the airport property. Another factor is they didn't find any nexus to terrorism. No explosives were found in this man's bag.
What do we know about this man?
We know that he was 44 years old. He's a U.S. citizen. There have been reports that he is originally from Costa Rica. He married a woman who is a U.S. citizen. And he came in yesterday to Miami, originally from Quito, on a connecting flight. So he only had stopped in Miami to make his connecting flight back to Orlando. He lived near Orlando. And I talked to, you know, a few neighbors of his who said that, you know, he was a very nice man, very gentle neighbor. So they didn't think the couple had any children, but they had lived there for some time, you know, typical suburban home. And he was, you know, a very quiet man. You know, he was friendly with his neighbors. They didn't see any past history of violent behavior. So this all came as a shock to everybody, and including some family members.
There were reports yesterday of mental illness on his part. Has that in any way been confirmed?
The Federal Air Marshal Service hasn't confirmed that yet. We hope to get an update today from the police in Miami as they investigate this. But several witnesses did say that they saw, as you guys have discussed, his wife, the passenger's wife, saying that he was on medication. You know, and that has been that will be a key part of the investigation, I believe, is looking into the training of air marshals. How much training do they receive in dealing with somebody who may have mental problems, and how is that different from how they would handle a situation where somebody, you know, has more violent intentions? So I think that's a big question.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line. This is Marianne. Marianne calling from Miami.
Hi there. Yeah, just two quick questions. One is, did anyone else aside from the U.S. Marshals hear that he had a bomb? And number two is, are tasers an option? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Marianne.
This is Sarah here. You know, the taser question has been brought up several times by many people in the aviation industry I've talked to today. Tasers are, looks like a gun. A taser is made by one company, Taser International in Arizona. It's plastic. It delivers an electric shock that is meant to disable somebody immediately for a short period of time. Many police departments across the country have adopted them. And there is a big debate about whether pilots should carry guns or whether they should carry tasers. The Federal Air Marshal Service from the beginning has always believed that they need the use of deadly force. So I don't think that that has ever been something that they have considered.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's interesting that, you know, people are now wondering this. I should say, though, that, you know, one thing about tasers is that there are a number of lawsuits against this company for wrongful death because people have died due to the use of this weapon.
Mm-hmm. And that, including some in Miami, as it happens. Douglas Laird, we're going to get to Marianne's other question in a moment. But Douglas Laird, the taser issue, is that something that you've looked into?
Yes, and what people don't understand about the taser is that they don't affect everybody the same way. I have seen videos where they've been used in a correctional situation, fired at an individual, and the person keeps on coming. You know, it doesn't stop them in the tracks like people are led to believe. So I think the federal air marshals are probably correct in saying that they will use a firearm.
Mm-hmm. The other issue about tasers and firearms, of course, if it were using on an airplane in the air, bullets have the possibility of punching a hole through the skin of the aircraft, possibly causing a decompression and or possibly hitting another passenger.
Well, the real fear there isn't the decompression of the aircraft because the bullet hole is relatively small, probably not large enough to do an explosive decompression. The real issue with a firearm is firing from the back of the plane toward the front and hitting critical avionics or hydraulic lines.
Okay. You were about to say something, Sarah? I'm sorry?
Oh, yes. One thing I think Doug and I actually have talked about is it was fascinating to hear a number of years ago, right after 9/11, that Boeing actually testified that if you did shoot a gun through the skin of an aircraft, it wouldn't necessarily have a major effect on the cabin pressure system, or it wouldn't bring down the aircraft, which I thought was kind of surprising. One would assume that that would be really catastrophic, but mm-hmm. That was, I guess, from based on experience, what Boeing had said.
And the other part of Marianne's question, did anyone other than the air marshals overhear the man saying, "I have a bomb"?
I haven't talked to anybody, Neil, any passengers who said that they did hear that. So I think that's going to be a critical part of the investigation. And one interesting thing I thought today was just talking to members of Congress who, you know, love to support their air marshals and are really big fans of the program, really being quiet and cautious today in their statements and saying, we don't know all the facts yet. We're not, before we call for any major overhauls or training changes to the air marshal program, we really kind of want to know all the facts, and I think that's a big one.
Mm-hmm. And the situation then, by extension, in the jetway, were there witnesses there to hear the challenge to whatever the challenge was and whatever see whatever his response was?
I'm not sure of that either. I think that all the passengers were removed from the aircraft at the rear of the plane, and that's the reason why. Obviously, they mm-hmm. had this crime scene there. I don't think – I would be surprised if anybody, any passengers saw it, none that I've talked to. It's quite possible that some flight crew members, possibly the pilots, might have seen it. But I don't know exactly at what stage this plane was in preparation for takeoff. The door was obviously open, but I don't know if the cockpit door is open. Once that cockpit door is closed, they are not supposed to open that door.
Generally, when it's open, there's almost always workers in there. Somebody, for one thing, to arrange the wheelchairs and whatnot to help people get off the plane.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Pam. Pam calling from Denver.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, Pam. Go ahead, please.
I'm a captain for a major U.S. airline, and I can tell you, I am really astonished that a show as thoughtful and considered as Talk of the Nation is taking time to second-guess the actions of these highly trained federal air marshals. I am always pleased to have them on board, and whatever action they took in this situation, I am sure was justified based on their training and experience. They are an asset to the safety of our aviation community, and I really am torqued that you guys are, as I say, second-guessing their actions.
We're asking about their actions, and Pam, even people who are brilliantly trained and get into a situation sometimes, and as people have said, adrenaline can take over. People make mistakes, Pam.
People do make mistakes, but I think that it's a little bit early, less than 24 hours after the incident, to start pointing fingers.
I didn't say we were pointing fingers. We're trying to find out what happened.
Well, I'm going to hope that there are people investigating this that are taking a more reasoned and considered approach in your program now.
Thank you, Pam.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Kobe calling us from Las Vegas.
Yes, hi. My question relates to the training regarding being able to identify mental illness. If this person was suffering from a mental illness, a well-trained or just a carefully trained eye to catch on clues would be able to identify that situation. I've worked in the mental health field, and sometimes police officers would demonize people with mental illness or criminalize them. And I'm just curious to hear some comments about or what steps are possibly being taken toward educating, certainly marshals as well as, other law enforcement agents in terms of being able to identify so that individuals who suffer from mental illness, if that is truly the case here.
Mm-hmm. We don't know that to be the case. But Sarah Gu, I know you've covered air marshal training. Is this one of the issues that they discuss?
Well, Neil, I visited their facility in Atlantic City, New Jersey, where they do a number of role-playing scenarios. And they don't just do scenarios involving somebody trying to hijack a plane. They actually play this out on an aircraft that they have. And I've sat on board it, and it's kind of like role play. One of the air marshals, puts an apron on and walks down the aisles and plays the role of the flight attendant. Other air marshals play the role of passengers. I saw one skit, if you will, where there was a drunk passenger who was getting increasingly violent, and the air marshals had to role play how they would react in that kind of situation. I've never seen them specifically do a role play situation where somebody who just appears to be mentally unstable. But when I talked to the air marshal's public affairs spokesperson today, he said that, a lot of these things are similar. You have somebody who's not all mentally there, whether they're intoxicated, they're not thinking as clearly as a normal person would. So sometimes their behavior is very similar. You know, that's one way you could say of dodging my question as to whether they do really do train specifically on, you know, mental illness, as the caller brought up. But they do a lot of scenarios that don't just focus on shooting, but really restraining passengers. And as you mentioned earlier, when and when not to jump up and identify themselves and when to allow the flight crew to deal with the passenger and handle it on their own.
And we should point out, I think this is the first time that air marshals have discharged their weapons in an incident in and around an aircraft since 9/11. So obviously they exercise restraint.
Yes.
All right. Kobe, thanks very much for the call.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Douglas Laird, I wanted to thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Douglas Laird is president of Laird & Associates, an aviation security consulting firm, former security director at Northwest Airlines, and he was with us on the phone from Reno, Nevada. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In the push for terrorism prevention since 9/11, the number of federal air marshals dramatically increased. One critic argues that the quality of training did not. Andrew Thomas is author of Air Rage, Crisis in the Skies. He teaches international business at the University of Akron and joins us from his office in Akron, Ohio. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
What's wrong with the training for air marshals?
Well, there was extensive reporting that came out after 9/11 that said in order to ramp up the number of air marshals flying in the skies, from the pre-9/11 numbers, which was less than three dozen, to the new environment that had been created because of the attacks, that a lot of the training that was very stringent and very professional for the air marshals, in fact, had to be scaled way back. And the belief is that you have many people that normally would not have been able to get into the air marshal program before 9/11. In fact, they had become air marshals because of the political imperative to get the program up and running.
Mm-hmm. Yet it's been a few years since then. Presumably, if there were bad apples, they've been weeded out.
That would be the hope. The concern, though, is that there is a lot of turnover in the agency. It was at one time sold as a very glamorous position. There's a lot of money paid to air marshals. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of health issues that have arisen for air marshals who've been up in the skies 50, 60 hours a week, and there's been a lot of turnover in the program. And we're at a situation right now where many of the screeners that are, in fact, going to be moved away from the checkpoints on December 22nd because of the lack of a focus now on items like knives and scissors. These people may now become available to serve in the air marshal program as well.
These small, sharp objects. The policy has recently changed to allow things like nail files and scissors.
Sure.
Yeah. And you've written extensively about air rage on airplanes, obviously.
Yeah.
Describe that for us. And obviously, this can be a touchy situation to describe. You know, trying to figure out what is a disturbed person, what is a air rage, and somebody who threatens the safety of the aircraft.
Yeah, air rage has been a problem that's been with us well before 9/11. I was able to document in my book of the same name about 10,000 cases of this stuff taking place in the year leading up to 9/11. In fact, there were 30 cockpit intrusions that took place before 9/11 by disruptive or deranged or passengers committing air rage, we'd call it. The problem went away for a while after 9/11 because people were much more cognizant of the way they behaved on airplanes. Security was a big issue, but now that we've got more people flying than ever before. We're starting to see this stuff come back 4 years after 9/11. And we see there's a direct relationship between the amount of customer complaints that the passengers make to the Department of Transportation and the number of air rage incidents we see. And these are becoming, as I said, more frequent, more intense many times. And the problem that we're facing is twofold. First is that air marshals have a very clear, definitive purpose, at least they're supposed to in their training, and that is an anti-terrorism function. And secondly, flight attendants have still been woefully trained to be able to do risk assessment and security training within the air cabin, and that creates a very difficult gray area for both flight attendants and air marshals in terms of how to handle incidents like yesterday.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah Gu, as you've suggested in talking to people in Congress and elsewhere, air marshals are going to be the focus of this investigation.
Yes, I think clearly, since the unprecedented nature of this kind of thing, to be honest with you, I think many of us in the press are not entirely surprised that a deadly incident like yesterday took place, given the fact that there are exponentially more guns on planes today than they were before 9/11, thousands and thousands, either whether they're on on airline pilots who've now been trained in the cockpit as federal flight deck officers or on undercover air marshals. Mm.
Well, thanks very much. Obviously, this is a story that's going to be continuing. Sarah Gu is the aviation reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Neil.
Sarah Gu joined us from the offices of The Washington Post here in Washington, D.C. And Andrew Thomas, thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Andrew,
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. Andrew Thomas is the author of Air Rage Crisis in the Skies. He teaches international business at the University of Akron and joined us from his office in Akron, Ohio. When we come back from a short break, we'll hear from the former U.S. attorney who prosecuted the case of the shoe bomber, Richard Reid, and we'll talk about Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and the confusion surrounding her statements about torture and secret prisons in Europe. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about air marshals and yesterday's incident at Miami International Airport, where two air marshals opened fire and killed a passenger aboard one of those airplanes, the first time air marshals have opened fire since 9/11. We're joined now by Gerald Leone, Senior Managing Director and Regional Counsel for the international security and investigation firm Vance. He's also a former U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney who prosecuted Richard Reid, who attempted to bring down an airliner in mid-flight in December 2001 by trying to ignite explosives hidden in his shoes. Gerry Leone joins us now by phone from Boston. Very good of you to take the time out of your day to meet with us, sir.
Thanks for having me.
And I wonder, on the basis of what we know thus far, do you feel the air marshals responded appropriately yesterday to the threat in Miami?
I do. Based upon the facts that are known to us now, it certainly seems like a reasonable use of force that the air marshal engaged in.
Mm-hmm. Can you run us through some of the specialized training that air marshals received to respond to in-flight threats?
Well, on the base level, they will get the conventional law enforcement training. But to consider where an incident might occur, 30,000 feet above the land and in a very crowded airplane, there are a number of different ways that they receive specialized training. One, of course, is in firearms usage and how you utilize that, options for using your firearm, certain hand techniques and hold techniques that allow you to apprehend somebody without having to use a weapon. There are intimidation tactics and techniques where they're able to read people and how people are acting and how they may react. There are commands that are provided and the ability to read a response from a person who's provided command. These are all specialized techniques which take into consideration how an incident may occur when you're 30,000 feet above the ground.
Because obviously in an airplane, one of the last things you want to do is use a firearm.
No, that's right. And that's why the air marshals are trained extensively on options for apprehending and quelling a disturbance that go far beyond the usage of the weapon.
Mm-hmm. To your knowledge, do air marshals' weapons use standard bullets or special soft-nose bullets that might not penetrate to hit either other passengers or critical parts of the plane or punch a hole in the plane?
That's exactly what air marshals use as far as bullets and rounds. They're the type of bullets and rounds that would not penetrate the fuselage of the plane so as not to trigger a hole in the plane, which could compromise the ability of the plane to travel on safely.
Take us back, if you would, to the so-called shoe bomber case that you were so closely involved in. And I wonder, what did we learn from that that helps us provide better security today?
Well, the first thought I had was of Christina Jones and Hermise Moutardier, the two flight attendants who actually apprehended Richard Reid. The fuse leading into his shoe that would have detonated the bomb was 6 inches long and had burned down approximately 3 inches. So if Christina and Hermes didn't act quickly, act on what they know, and apprehend Richard Reid, that would have put that plane down and 188 people would have died. That's the first reaction I had when I thought of this quick-thinking scenario and situation which played out yesterday. Things we've learned, one of the things we learned, which is extremely important, is that despite all of the different precautions that are put in place, despite the fact that Richard Reid had gone through many different safety measures and procedures, he got that bomb on the plane because, very simply put, they devised a bomb that had no metallic components, and at that time, we had no way of detecting any of the components that made up the bomb that was in his shoe.
Since then, we've all learned how to tie our shoes much more quickly than we used to.
Well, that's one of the unfortunate realities after the Richard Reed matter is that we're all taking our footwear off a lot more frequently. However, I'm sure as you know, there are devices now in airports which allow one to walk through and get a blast of air, which detects certain components which would be part of a bomb, so that people don't have to take their footwear off. But frankly, you know, in the United States, what we really need to do is we need to create a systematic approach to this whereby the checking mechanism would check on the chemical components that could be used in an explosive device rather than checking for metallic-type components, which is extremely labor-intensive.
Mm-hmm. Was there an air marshal on the flight that Mr. Reed was on?
No.
And I wonder, obviously, the exact number of air marshals hired and used since then is classified, but on the basis of what you know, are you satisfied in terms of what you've seen in terms of this program's acceleration?
Yes, if you consider that there were 33 air marshals just prior to September 11th, and now, although it's not for public consumption, but an approximation is thousands of air marshals are now employed and receiving all the specialized training, that, you know, I think we can be confident that the majority of our planes and the message that are being sent to would-be terrorists is that these planes are very, very secure with professionals who are trained in a manner to avert danger on our planes.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Larry, and Larry's calling us from Miami.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I'm really distressed that so many callers are saying that they think the air marshals did the right thing. This poor dead man did not have a bomb or a gun or a knife or even a box cutter. He was just acting strange, and now they've killed him. He was not on an airplane in flight, not even on an airplane on the ground. And I think that people who don't see that there is at least a question to be asked about this have somehow lost their moral compass.
Gerald Leone, again, we're not quite sure of all of the facts in this case. Obviously, there will be an investigation. And clearly, something did go wrong as to who did wrong. That remains to be determined.
Sure. I mean, this is an extremely unfortunate, tragic incident. Say that right up front. But when a law enforcement officer acts in the manner that this law enforcement officer did, there's always an assessment over what they did, why, and how. And in this circumstance, the fact of the matter was what was known to that law enforcement officer at the time was he had an agitated individual who said he had a bomb, who was carrying a bag which could have had the bomb within it, was asked to place the bag down on more than one occasion, ignored the requests of the air marshal, and was headed towards a plane full of people. Under those circumstances, that air marshal had seconds to make a decision, and his decision was to pull his weapon and use it.
Well, that's my problem with this. There's the culture of the gun is going to solve things.
Well, Larry, all these questions will be gone into in considerably more depth as the investigation continues, but thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome.
And Gerard Leone, thank you for being with us today. We know you're busy. We appreciate your time.
No, thanks for having me.
Gerard Leone, Senior Managing Director and Regional Counsel for the international security and investigation firm Vant. He's the Assistant U.S. Attorney who prosecuted shoe bomber Richard Reed. He joined us by phone from Boston.